Well, this term we're studying the greatest of Paul's epistles, Romans, the Epistle to the Romans, and today we come to chapter 3, and we're just going to look at the last section of the chapter, really just verses 21 to 26. Perhaps you'd like to have it open in front of you, and I'll just read the first part of verse 21. But now the righteousness of God has been manifested. There's a tremendous satisfaction in getting something right, isn't there? It's one of the exhortations that Dick gives to us from time to time at staff meetings. You say, now come on, let's get it right. Let's get it right first time. There's immense satisfaction in getting something right, particularly anything that demands skill or artistic skill. If you're perhaps, shall we say, a singer like those who've been leading us today, or a dancer like Martin Blogg and his team, even perhaps I can say if you're a preacher, there's a great satisfaction in getting it right. There's a satisfaction in being right which is quite independent of the praise of other people, or even the sense of your own self-satisfaction, the sense of being right with an absolute standard. Now, that absolute standard, of course, rests with God Himself. God is the absolute standard of what is right. He always gets it right. We're familiar perhaps with that expression that we use sometimes about being in the right or in the clear. And God's always in the right. And one of the things that Paul has been wanting to say in this epistle, you may remember that right at the beginning, back in chapter 1 and verse 17, one of the things that Paul has emphasized is that the gospel reveals God's righteousness. Because if God's gospel doesn't reveal God's righteousness, if God hasn't got things right in the gospel, if in any way it's a sham or a trick or a cheat, well then there's no gospel. The gospel must be right. It must embody God's righteousness. And this is what this passage is all about. How the righteousness of God, God's rightness, comes out in the gospel. And as I look through the themes of these verses, it seems to me that they all seem to go in pairs. We've got three twins, and putting them like that may help to fix it in your minds a bit. And so the first one is this. The first one is God's twin righteousness. God's twin righteousness. There are two aspects to God's righteousness. What I would call His inward, His internal righteousness, and His outward or external righteousness. Just think about those. His inward righteousness, God's inward righteousness, is the righteousness that's in Him, His own inherent righteousness. It's His quality of being right. And from this point of view, God has always got to be true to Himself. He can't be false to His own nature. He's got to be consistent within Himself. The righteousness of God, that's what it means. His inward righteousness, His own right character. That, I suppose, is the obvious sense of the phrase. But as well as speaking about His inward righteousness, this phrase also speaks about His outward righteousness. The righteousness of God is not only the righteousness that's in Him, it's also, wonderful to say, a righteousness that goes out from Him, that He is willing to bestow upon those who put their trust in Him. You've got this hinted at already in verse 22. You see, verse 21 speaks about the righteousness of God. Verse 22 takes it up. the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. You see what he's implying? That there is a righteousness of God which waits for all who believe. It's something available to them. So this righteousness of God isn't just his quality of being right in himself. It's his quality of doing right. Or perhaps to put it slightly differently, of putting right, or putting in the right, people like you and me who at present are in the wrong. God's righteousness isn't just something in himself that he sits and is satisfied with. It goes out from him. It's a positive, active righteousness which seeks to put in the right people like you and me who are at present are in the wrong. And Paul has a special word to express this idea of putting in the right. The word that he uses is the word to justify. It comes in verse 24. They, that's people like you and me, are justified by his grace as a gift. You've got it again in verse 26. It was to prove at the present time that he himself is righteousness and that he justifies him who has faith in Jesus. To justify is a legal term. In Israel, the judges were told that when they had to try a case, if a man turned out to be righteous, they were to justify him, declare him to be in the right. If a man turned out to be guilty, they were to condemn him. To justify means to acquit. It's the opposite of condemn. It means to declare to be in the right, to put in the right. So that's what God's willing to do. He not only has his own righteousness, which he must keep uncompromised, he also has this outgoing righteousness which he will confer upon those who put their trust in him. I can't say that I've ever read the Melanesian Pidgin English New Testament, but I'm told that the way they translate this word justified or justify is really very vivid. And the way the Pidgin English New Testament translates it is this: God e say immol right. God e say immol right. When God justifies, God says he's all right, he's in the right. If you like to be even more simple, you may know the old Sunday school definition of the word justified. What does justified mean? It means that I'm made just as if I'd never sinned. Just as if I'd never sinned. God, he say, immor right. Now, these two righteousnesses, these twin aspects of God's righteousness, might seem to be at war with each other, to militate against each other. Because surely if God puts in the right those who are really in the wrong, if he declares them to be right when they're wrong, isn't God compromising his own righteousness? He's doing just the thing that he told judges in the Old Testament not to do. He told the judges they must justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. And yet here is God, the righteous one, justifying those who are not right. There seems to be this conflict between God's inward righteousness and his outward righteousness. And how's God going to reconcile it? Well, that leads me to the second theme, the second twin. And this twin is connected with the cross. I'll call it the cross's twin purpose. The cross's twin purpose. Two purposes the cross has. The first purpose is a purpose for God, for him. And the purpose of the cross, from God's point of view, for God's sake, is to demonstrate his righteousness. This is something that Paul emphasizes several times. For instance, verse 24, this was to show God's righteousness. Verse 26, it was to prove at the present time that he himself is righteous. In verse 21, the righteousness of God has been manifested. If God's going to do something that appears to be unrighteous, then he's got to make a demonstration that proves that in fact he's not being unrighteous. And the way that he does this is through the cross. And this is expressed in verse 25, where speaking about Christ, we read that God put him forward as an expiation by his blood to be received by faith. Sometimes people say that it's easy for God to forgive. Well, I mean, of course God can forgive. That's what he's there for. I mean, that's the sort of God that he is. He likes forgiving. Well, God does like forgiving. But the problem is, the difficulty is, that he must find a way of forgiving that does not in the process compromise his hostility to sin and to evil. Even in the act of forgiving, God must maintain uncompromised his irreconcilable opposition to sin and evil. Otherwise, he ceases to be righteous. His inward righteousness is compromised. And the way he does this is through the cross. And the cross here is described as, or through the cross, Christ is put forward as an expiation, as the older versions put it, as a propitiation by his blood. What does this language mean? Well, both these words, propitiation, expiation, have to do with putting right wrongs. You propitiate a person who has been wronged. You appease him, placate him. And God's hostility to evil, as it were, has got to be propitiated, placated. You expiate the wrong. You, as it were, disinfect it of its evil and its offensiveness. You expiate it. So both these words, I mean, they're both words which describe this process of making some compensation for a wrong. And they're words that are regularly linked in the Bible with the idea of God's wrath. And you may remember the second half of chapter 1 spoke to us in detail about God's wrath. And we saw that God's wrath isn't a sort of peak. It has none of the selfishness of human anger. God's wrath is simply a technical term meaning his hostility to evil. And if he's going to forgive, he must do so in a way which shows that he's not overlooked his hostility to evil. And he does this through the cross, through the death of Jesus. That's what's meant by his blood, by his dying. And in the cross, God shows what sin and evil means to him. That for him to forgive sin is no light thing. It's the costliest thing in the world. It required nothing less than the death of his son. Whenever anybody is wronged, there are only two ways in which he can react. He can either seek to obtain recompense, exact revenge, get his own back. He can do that. He can claim justice. Or else, he can bear what is done. He doesn't demand his own back. He bears it. He accepts it. He takes it. And in the cross, we see God not exacting recompense from us for our sins, but bearing in his own person, in his Son, all that our sins mean to him and cost him. Nothing less than this is what it costs God to forgive. Only in this way can he show that he hates evil and yet is able to forgive it. And so, for God, the cross is the way in which he reconciles his inward righteousness and his outward righteousness. It's the way he finds of forgiving sin, which doesn't compromise his hostility to it. So, it's necessary for God. But then also, it's necessary for man. I referred a moment ago to people who glibly go around saying, oh, well, it's easy for God to forgive. Of course he can forgive. Now, the only trouble about easy forgiveness is that it doesn't actually forgive. It doesn't relieve the pain and guilt of sin. One of the most difficult problems brought to a Christian minister that I've ever come across is a story contained in a book called The Tartan Pimpernel by Donald Caskey. He was chaplain to the Scots Church in Paris at the outbreak of the last war, and when Paris was invaded, he moved to Marseilles and took over a seaman's mission, and in that situation he helped escape prisoners of war to get away to neutral countries. And one day a prisoner came through his hands who was absolutely in the depths of despair. He seemed as good as dead, and none of his friends could help him. And for a long time he wouldn't say what the matter was, but finally he opened up. And his story was this. He'd come from a remote part of Scotland, from a small, exclusive sect of Christian people. He'd hated the war, he'd hated the army, and he hated being in the prison camp. He was quite cut off from his friends. But one of the German guards belonged to the same religious group, and this guard befriended him. And it was through that befriending that he had the opportunity to escape. He got put on a slightly easier job involving going out in a working party outside the camp. And he succeeded in hiding himself while the party was out, escaping, returning to camp, and he remained there till darkness to make his escape. And he was about to do so when, to his horror, he saw somebody coming towards him through the darkness. He was gripped by panic. He seized an iron bar that was lying there, and as the man drew near to him, he raised it above his head and he battered the man over the head and battered him to death. When he looked at the man face to face, he saw that it was the guard who had befriended him. Now, you can imagine the horror that he felt. Now, if you go to a person in that situation, say, never mind, it doesn't matter, that's all right, God will forgive it. That easy forgiveness doesn't forgive. Only those who have not felt sin, have not felt its agony and its distress, can take comfort in easy forgiveness. But those who know what sin and evil really is cannot find any help in easy forgiveness at all. Therefore, you see, it's only a God who hates sin who can relieve its guilt. It's only a God who has first said that sin matters who can then go on to point a way in which he can say that now it no longer matters. It's only a God who demonstrates his own righteousness, in other words, his own irreconcilable hostility to evil, who can then go on to establish man's righteousness. We've got to have the two. Unless God remains righteous while he counts us right, then the process is no good. It's no good for him, because he's compromised his righteousness. It's no good for us, because for us we shall see that this process of declaring us to be righteous is just a business of playing with words. It hasn't meant anything. But when we see that the cross is the propitiation through which God's wrath has been averted, then the cross becomes what it's called in verse 24. It becomes redemption. Redemption. That means something that tells us that the price has been paid for our ransom. We can be set free. Our bondage isn't treated lightly. It's not pretended that it doesn't exist. No, it's given its full weight. And a price that is equal to it is paid, so that you and I can be set free, ransomed, healed, restored, forgiven, to go out to new life in a new land. So, we've seen God's twin righteousness, the cross's twin purpose. We end finally by seeing salvation's twin channels. Salvation's twin channels. And these are first grace and second faith. Verse 24, they're justified by his grace as a gift. Supposing I was to say to you something quite absurd, but supposing I was to lay down from some sort of private whim that in future no one would be allowed to attend morning service at St. Helens unless they came here in a Rolls Royce. Don't worry, I'm not going to do this. But supposing I laid down this as an essential condition, then there would be only two ways in which you could be able to get to the morning service and participate. One would be that you should provide the Rolls Royce yourself. Do it yourself. And if we use the terms that Paul uses, that would mean that by your own works, by your own efforts, by your own merits, you would provide it. But you might turn around and say, well, look, I'm sorry, Jim, but there's just no way that I'm going to be able to get hold of a Rolls Royce to come to church in. And therefore, if I still insisted on that condition, the only way in which it would be fulfilled would be if I provided the Rolls Royce. Now, that's what's meant by grace. God justifies us by his grace. He provides the way as a free gift. It doesn't depend upon what we do at all. It depends upon what he has done for us. And grace is God's way of salvation viewed from his side. From our side, the way of receiving it is faith. But faith and grace go hand in hand. We mustn't imagine that our faith is something by which we earn salvation. Faith is just simply the empty hand that we put out by which we receive God's free gift. Because when you have faith, what it means is that you ascribe all the merit to God and none at all to yourself. The faith that you're asked to have isn't a faith that says, well, there's something in me. It's a faith that says, it's all in him. I believe that God is a God who justifies freely. I really believe that he's like that. I remember many years ago watching a cricket match between two teams of small boys. It was quite a tense game. The first side went in, we were all out. The second side went in and they were overhauling their opponent's score, but the wickets were going down fast as well. And there were only a few more runs to go, but another wicket fell. And one of the last batsmen came in, and he wasn't any good with a bat. But he was determined in this tense situation not to let his side down. And so he was crouching over every ball, watching carefully, playing a straight bat and all the rest of it. He wasn't going to let his wicket be lost. He was going to strain every nerve to win the victory. While this was going on, there was also some activity in the pavilion, because the scorers also were little boys, and mathematics wasn't their strong point. And as they looked over their scorebooks, they found that, in fact, they'd made a mistake. And, in fact, the game was already over. The opponent's score had already been passed. And so suddenly there was a cry from the pavilion, "It's all right. It's finished. It's over. We've won." Now, there was that poor little boy striving might and main to win a victory that had already been won by others. And this is what many people are doing in this world today, striving by their efforts to win a victory that in fact was won for them by Jesus Christ on the cross. And the gospel of Christ is not summed up in two words, D-O, do, but it's summed up in the four letters, D-O-N-E, done. It was all done on the cross because God set him forth as a propitiation and expiation by his blood to be received by faith. God is able to be both righteous himself and the one who can justify, put in the right, those who believe in Christ. And what he asks of us is not to go doing yet more ourselves, but to receive humbly as little children what was done for us there once for all. God's twin righteousness, his inward righteousness in himself, his outgoing righteousness to you, to me. The cross's twin purposes. They demonstrate that his inward righteousness is not compromised, and therefore they make it possible for us to know credibly that there is an outward righteousness for us to receive. It's available through these twin channels of his grace that gives it freely and our faith that receives it humbly.